And now, back to brainstorming with Billy.
It turns the brains into guacamole.
Now, here's your host, Billy the Brain.
Welcome back. This is Bill Frank, and you're listening to Brainstorming with Billy the Brain here on KKZZ, Positive Talk Radio for Ventura and Santa Barbara counties. Every show has a theme, and today's theme is business, business, business. Each of my guests is explaining his expertise in one facet of business. My next guest is a director at one of the world's largest consultancies. He's also the co-author with Clayton Christensen on the Innovators series of books. We'll discuss guidelines to be more innovative from his latest book, The Innovators Manifesto. And if you want to ask a question or if you want to join in the conversation, you can always call us at 639-0008. And you want to keep that number handy because I'll be taking the third caller right now for two sandwiches or two salads from Urbane Cafe. And you can call in and win that. Be the third caller at 639-0008, and the sandwiches or the salads are yours. My next guest, Michael Rayner, is both a doctor and a director with Deloitte Consulting LLP. He works with senior executives in the world's leading corporations across a wide range of industries. He is the author of two best-selling and critically acclaimed books, The Innovator's Solution, co-authored, as I said, with Clayton Christensen, and The Strategy Paradox. His latest book, The Innovator's Manifesto, demonstrates that the careful application of the right theory improves overall innovation rates of success. Michael's lectured widely, delivering over 100 major presentations and workshops around the world each and every year. He's a columnist for the Conference Board Review, and he publishes in leading magazines and scholarly journals. He holds a DBA in general management from Harvard Business School, an MBA from the Ivy Business School in London, Canada, and a philosophy degree from Harvard University. He lives and is joining us from Canada. Hi, Michael. How are you today?
I'm well. Thanks so much for having me on the show.
Well, thank you for being our guest, because I love, first of all, the work that you've done with Michael, with Clayton Christensen, and I love your new book, The Innovator's Manifesto. So your book explains the how and the why of disruption and how that leads to creativity. And I kind of refer back to Joseph Schumpeter's coined the term creative destruction. So in what ways is disruption different from or similar to creative destruction?
Well, I think, so Schumpeter was a mid-century economist. He did most of his work in the 1930s and 1940s. And he's most famous for coining the term, as you point out, creative destruction. And really what he was pointing to is the fact that sort of incremental innovations, things that find a way to reduce the price of something by 5 or 10%, it's all well and good. But the kinds of innovations that really remake the landscape, are innovations that fundamentally reshape how companies go about creating value. I mean, that's kind of a sort of a vague statement, but it rather than making a mainframe 10% less expensive, 10% less costly, the innovations that really shake things up are things like creating the personal computer, right? Something that costs, you know, 10% of the cost of a mainframe, or 1%, right? Those are the kinds of changes that matter. And that was really his signal contribution. What I've tried to describe is the mechanism by which that actually happens. So Schumpeter described that it happens. He observed that's what's important. But until now, I think we really haven't had a clear line of sight between specific activities and actually making those kinds of breakthroughs. And that's what I think disruption does.
Well, without a doubt. And you're turning it from an art form into a science. So I guess my question for you is, isn't innovation just by its nature an artistic expression? How can you become scientific about it?
I think that's a great question. And my take on it is that innovation is not intrinsically an art. And what I mean by that is that some things, painting, sculpture, and so forth, those really do feel like it's hard to be systematic about it. Some of us may get better if we practice long enough, but whether or not you've got that sort of innate spark that allows you to create something truly great that survives through the centuries, well, who's to say? But there's another way in which we use the term. Right? When we say something is an art form, very often what we mean, I think, is that we really just don't understand it particularly well. It's possible to understand it, but we're not there yet. And I think a good analogy comes to us from the world of medicine. I mean, there was a time when it was referred to as the medical arts. You know, you still see those buildings around, you know, the medical arts buildings.
Yes, yes.
But trust me, nobody wants to go to a doctor who says, you know, it's an art form, you've got to trust my intuition. Right? What you want is somebody who knows how to diagnose a disease, knows what the tests mean, and knows how to prescribe the right treatment as a result of those tests.
Right.
So but, medicine has evolved, right? We've gotten better because we understand more deeply what's actually going on. I think when we say innovation is an art, then I think what we're talking about is sort of medieval medicine. It could be a science, but we haven't quite figured out how to get there.
All right.
And in the Innovator's Manifesto, I think I've tried to take the first steps in that direction.
And you've done a good job. I want you to come back. We'll talk about medicine a little bit later, because I think medicine is still very much art form. We do rely too much on the doctor's experience to diagnose things, but that's a conversation for another time. You are talking about disruption and making it into a science, and you break it down into disruption has predictive powers, it has explanatory powers, and then you can apply it. So for my audience, let's go through this. How can disruption have predictive power?
Well, implicitly, I think every theory that any business person ever picks up to use is being used to make predictions, right? You decide you're going to run an advertising campaign with the expectation it's going to increase your sales. So when you make an ad buy, you are predicting that it will have a positive impact. So pretty much everything we do is implicitly a prediction. The problem is that most of the theories we use to make these predictions haven't been tested for their predictive power. Do they actually make us better? And that's something that most business books tend not to do, right? Usually it's a series of cherry-picked case examples that they then sort of apply their theory to and say, look at that, my theory magically happens to explain all the examples that I happen to choose to put in my book. How about that? So what I've tried to do in Manifesto is actually work with a data set that was provided by another organization entirely, in my case Intel Corporation, and applied disruption theory to their portfolio of investments to see if the application of disruption theory improved the predictive accuracy. Were we able to pick the winners more accurately as a result of using disruption theory? And it turns out that we can.
And so how did that work? Explain it for my listeners.
Well, we were enormously fortunate that Intel chose to collaborate with us to do this work. What they made available to us was a portfolio of 48 businesses that they had actually funded. So these were business ideas that had bubbled up from inside Intel, and they had provided funding on the level of anywhere from, call it $250,000 to $2 million.
Wow.
So these are very early stage business ideas.
Mm-hmm.
Right? This is not the venture capital world, right?
Very
right. Early stage stuff. On a magnitude, I think, that a lot of people can still relate to. And we had survival data on those businesses. So we had anywhere from 3 to 10 years of post-funding survival data. We knew whether or not those businesses had survived or not.
Mm-hmm.
Now, it's really hard to launch new businesses successfully, so you won't be surprised to hear that not all of them made it. That's hardly a criticism.
Right.
What we did, though, is we took those businesses and we wrote them up as 2-page disguised business plans. And we did a series of experiments at 3 business schools, Harvard, MIT, both of which are in Boston, and the Ivy Business School in London, Canada, which is where I went to school. And using a population of 500 business school students, we got all of those folks to read the business cases and make their own predictions without knowing how they fared, without knowing how those businesses had done.
Okay.
We then gave them a lecture on disruption theory, right? So they made their predictions using whatever it is you have in your head at the end of the first year of a top-notch MBA program. We then gave them a 1-hour lecture on disruption theory and said, now try it again. And wouldn't you know, as a population, they got up to 50% better.
Wow. I mean, that's amazing. So after explaining disruption theory to them, they went back and applied it to those exact same case studies and dramatically improved their predictive powers. Which,
I think so. You always have to be somewhat circumspect with these sorts of data. I don't want to overstate what I think we found, but I tell you, there's two of us on the phone here. One of us is impressed, right?
Yeah.
At least one of us.
Yeah, I am.
I think it matters. The success rate of Intel's underlying portfolio, the portfolio that Intel actually invested in, was running around 10.5%, and the portfolio that the business school students picked, without knowing about disruption theory, was also about 10.5%. No real difference.
Wow.
But when they used disruption theory, their success rate was up to 15%. So that's a big improvement.
Yes.
15% is a long way from 100. So I'm not confused about that. If I had something that allowed me to pick winners 100% of the time, I don't think I'd be working for a living anymore. but it is an important improvement, I think.
It is. Now, did Intel take these findings and go back, and are they now applying the predictive power to any future projects that they are evaluating?
Yeah, Intel has been working with disruption theory really for a long time, and they continue to refine its application and adopt and adapt the principles to the work that they do. So, absolutely, they continue to be in the business of learning how to do this ever more effectively, and disruption is certainly part of their toolkit.
Wow. My guest is Michael Rayner, author of the book, The Innovator's Manifesto, Deliberate Disruption for Transformational Growth. And that's what we're talking about, disruption and transformational growth. So the second stage or the second part of your book, Michael, is that disruption has explanatory powers. What do you mean by that? And then I've got a follow-on question after you lay out what you mean by that.
Sure. No, thank you. So it's important to be able to predict. You have to show that you can predict accurately what's going to happen next, right? That's the predictive aspect that we've just covered.
Mm-hmm.
But it's important to get it right for the right reasons, right? Sometimes, you know, my astrologist tells me, look at all the predictions I've made, right? I have great predictive power. But my astrologist, when they get it right for the wrong reasons. You know, they get it right because they just got lucky. And so as a consequence, you really don't want to take their advice particularly seriously when it comes to what happens next. And so it's important to understand whether or not a theory has a legitimate claim on accurately describing, if you'll forgive the term, the causal mechanisms. You know, what causes what and why.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm referring back to the medicine analogy from earlier in our conversation. You know, sometimes people say, eat this chicken soup and your cold will get better. Turns out that there's perfect correlation between eating chicken soup and the cold going away, but nobody really thinks the chicken soup had much to do with it.
Right.
So you need to make sure that your theory accurately describes what causes what and why. So I spent some time making the case for disruption theory's superior explanatory power. Not only do we predict things more accurately, but we make those predictions for the right reasons.
All right, and based in that or bundled in that is a concept that you call pseudo-disruptions. Now, what are pseudo-disruptions?
Well, disruption theory, I'm happy to say, has actually been really quite successful in the general marketplace for ideas ever since Clayton's first book in 1997 up through, here's hoping, The Innovator's Manifesto. A lot of people have picked up on the ideas, and the good news is that, well, it's popular, it's kind of resonated with a lot of folks, and Clayton and to a lesser extent I are very gratified by that. The problem is that the term is often used somewhat indiscriminately. All of a sudden, anything that's successful or revolutionary is deemed to be a disruptor. And I don't think that's actually correct, right? Disruption theory is useful when we can define its terms precisely and thereby use the theory accurately.
All right.
So I've worked hard to try and distinguish between great businesses, fantastic strategic innovations, but they are nevertheless not disruptors.
Okay. Let's apply the disruption theory then to something that we're all very familiar with to make it more concrete in the minds of my listeners. And let's talk about it in relationship to portable music. In the 60s, we had transistor radios were the rage. Everybody carried around a transistor radio. In the 70s and the early 80s, it was the Walkman. The Walkman was supplanted by the iPod. The iPod is being supplanted by the iPhone. Talk to me about disruptive theory and its predictive powers using that as an example.
Sure, absolutely. I think, well, because those are historical examples where we already know the answer.
It's probably explanatory.
I'm sorry?
It's probably explanatory. You're right.
Yeah, exactly. That was exactly my point. So, yeah, I would agree completely. But nevertheless, I think it's a useful illustration. I think in most instances, each one of the waves of innovation that you described were disruptions because they played out in a very particular way. Each generation of technology essentially found its beginnings with segments of the market for music that were of effectively no interest, or at least relatively little interest, to the highly successful incumbents of the day. Right? So when you think about things like the tinny-sounding transistor radios of the 1950s that Sony was making, RCA was busy making stereophonic, I think they called it,
That's right.
equipment for your living room that was essentially a piece of furniture. And so as a consequence, Sony was making a device that it was selling for very relatively low prices with thin margins to unattractive markets, and so RCA wasn't interested. But Sony, of course, went from that initial foothold to becoming the dominant provider of portable music listening devices.
Mm-hmm.
And we had the same sort of thing play out with the transition to digital music and portable digital music players. The Apple iPod, of course, came into the market, I want to say, around 2001.
That's right.
And at that time, the market for portable digital music players was still pretty unformed. There were a number of other MP3 players, but it's hard to say that there was some dominant incumbent that was really ruling the roost. What Apple did that was, I think, so revolutionary is that they focused on a completely different set of technologies, right? So rather than being based in flash drives, it was based in disk drives. It was large and relatively clunky compared to the other MP3 players, but they wrapped a service around that device that allowed them to appeal to a very different set of needs and solve the real problem, which is not how do I make this thing small, but how do I make this thing able, how am I able to get lots of music that I want on this thing conveniently and inexpensively, and that was the problem that Apple solved.
That's a great explanation. My guest is Michael Rayner, author of the book, The Innovator's Manifesto, and it's Friday. I'm feeling good. We're going to give away two more sandwiches or two more salads, this time to the second caller, 639-0008. Call in, Tom. We'll get your name and your information, and we'll get you those coupons just in time for the weekend, give you something so that you can have a free lunch or free dinner with your loved one. So, Michael, looking back at your book, The Innovator's Manifesto, what do you want readers to take away from reading the book?
Well, at the risk of getting too highfalutin, I hope they take away a sense of hope, frankly, that innovation is something that you don't need to be, you know, one of the magically anointed creative few that somehow seems miraculously able to come up with a great idea. What I'm suggesting is that unlike a great painting or a great sculpture, it is in fact possible to come up with a great innovation through the careful application of a set of very specific rules, and so the idea then is that again, you don't have to be Jackson Pollock or Leonardo da Vinci to make a great painting. You can in fact be someone who's simply willing to do hard work and think carefully about the issues, and as a consequence, come up with something that's successful.
Oh, that is great. My guest has been Michael Rayner, author of the book, The Innovator's Manifesto, Deliberate Disruption for Transformational Growth. Michael, if people are intrigued by this subject, they want to learn more about you, learn more about the book, where would you direct them to go on the Internet?
Well, if you go to Deloitte.com/Innovator's Manifesto, you can find me there. And the book, of course, is for sale in all the usual places you'd expect to find books for sale.
Including our own Bank of Books here in Ventura. Two locations to serve you, 748 East Main Street and 2682 East Main Street. Michael, thank you so much for being our special guest here on Brainstorming with Billy the Brain. We'll talk to you down the road.
It's been my pleasure.
Take care. Thank you. Take care.